This is the WGBH Forum Network.
Hello, I'm Derek Pitts, Chief Astronomer at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia. What you're about to hear is a story about a terrible disease called sickle cell and an extraordinary doctor named Kwaku Ohene-Frimpong. They are at war, these two, on many fronts, both here and in Africa. And it's not just a medical challenge. It's personal.
He was 3 days old when we knew he had sickle cell disease. From then on till now, I don't think I can think of my son and not think about his health.
You may not be acquainted with sickle cell disease, but it's important because so many are suffering and so many can be helped. Also because hearing about Dr. Frimpong's work is like getting a second opinion on how to live a life of meaning. Now, Chasing the Crescent Moon, the story of Dr. Frimpong and sickle cell disease. The reporter is Aaron Schwartz.
Emmanuel Kolite Jr. was traveling with his family through Kumasi, Ghana's second largest city, on New Year's Day. They took a trotro, the cramped and dangerous microbuses that speed through town.
Suddenly on the way, the rear left tire got burst, and the car just came crashing down. All the other people have landed on me, and my hand was going down right onto the street. The next moment, it has stopped. Dust, fumes, everything was in the car. The flesh was removed from the elbow down to the wrist. Only the bone showed. But then I stopped and said, well, this and sickle cell, which one is more painful? Honestly, when I have attack from sickle cell, it's more painful than this that I was having. I tell you, it's like being torn apart.
In West Africa, 2% of babies are born with sickle cell disease. That's 1 in 50, an enormous figure. For African Americans, it's 1 in 400, still the most common genetic disease newborns are tested for. What exactly is sickle cell? How do you get it? And why is it so painful? Here's what scientists have learned. It's a genetic disease, primarily affecting people of African descent. But it also strikes people from the Mediterranean, Middle East, or South Asia. Sickle cell patients are tagged at birth. Patients share a single common DNA letter mutation in their genes for hemoglobin, the major component of red blood cells and the carrier of oxygen to all the body's tissues. It's one change in a 3 billion letter DNA code. These mutant hemoglobins tend to stick together, which makes the blood cells take the shape of a crescent moon, a sickle. In their new shape, they have trouble flowing through small blood vessels, depriving parts of the body of oxygen. One common result is called the pain crisis, a severe episode which can last 4 to 5 days. And it hurts just as much in the first world as the third.
Then you get that jaw, and all of a sudden, you know, it's ow! Because sickle cell pain produced so much pain that it was irrational to believe that there was a God out there that could allow someone to suffer as much as I did.
Other complications include stroke, damage to multiple organs, and joint damage. The spleen, crucial to a healthy immune system, is often impaired, leaving young children susceptible to infection. This is why estimates suggest half of Africans born with sickle cell die before they reach 5 years old. But this fate is preventable. Patients who are diagnosed and treated can live to adulthood and even old age. The defective hemoglobin is a recessive trait. People who have one bad gene and one normal gene won't show signs of the disease. But if two of them have kids, it's a dangerous lottery, and there's a 1 in 4 chance the child will receive 2 bad genes and have sickle cell disease. Dr. Kwaku Ohene-Frimpong was a medical student at Yale University when his son lost the sickle cell lottery.
He was 3 days old when we knew he had sickle cell disease.
Symptoms showed themselves in a few months.
Then you begin to wonder whether you did the right thing. Is your child going to die? Is going to have a lot of pain? I would say that from then on till now, I don't think I can think of my son and not think about his health.
That was 35 years ago. And Frimpong has spent those 35 years fighting the disease he carries and his son suffers from. He has had remarkable success, both here in the United States and in Ghana. Frimpong was born in Ghana to a family of cocoa farmers.
Saturday we go to the farms to help. We would weed, we would gather, you know, I never enjoyed it, but, you know, it's a duty, so we did it.
But Frempong soon left the farm with a scholarship to the best boarding school in the country. There, he was the national champion in the high hurdles, long jump, and triple jump, but he was set on becoming a doctor. Even after his track skills and good grades won him a scholarship to Yale, he wouldn't compromise his heavy pre-med coursework to train harder. He felt guilty for not giving his all to the team, but his coach didn't mind. After all, he was still winning. Selected to compete in the 1968 Olympic Games, Frempong made what he says was an easy decision.
For me, the whole idea that I was going to miss maybe half a semester or a semester because I was going to participate in the Olympic Games for 2 weeks, the two did not match. So I missed, you know, competing in the games. They still list me as a member of the team, but I did not actually compete.
It was in college that Frempong first became aware of sickle cell and realized that he had seen it before.
There was a Ghanaian doctor invited to speak at Yale Medical School, and he was talking about sickle cell disease. And I kept thinking, he's talking about my cousin. I have a cousin who died of this disease. By the time I went to high school, he was already dead. He died at about 16 years of age. He only lived about half a block from where I lived. And so I would go there almost every day. And I know that many times when you would go, he would be in his room and wouldn't come out. And you could hear him moaning in severe pain. I remember that his eyes were always very, very yellow. His jaundice, which is part of the sickle cell disease. He was very skinny, always looked like somebody who was ill. I knew that there was something about him, but at the time, I don't think anybody was going to explain to me what he had. But his image has always been in my mind because he's really the first person I knew with the signs and symptoms of this disease.
But it wasn't until his son was born that Frempong considered making sickle cell disease his life's work. He already dealt with the disease every day, at home.
You as a parent, you have to decide whether you're going to teach this child how to fight the pain and try to do as much as he can, or whether you're going to be so overly sympathetic that you're going to cry with your child. And so I had to teach my son to walk when he was limping. I knew he was in pain, and I could cry inside watching him do it. But I could carry him to the bathroom, or he can limp to the bathroom. But my own sense was always that if I carried him to the bathroom every time, suppose I'm not there, what is he going to do? And so then I would say, well, I'll hold your hand or whatever, but you try to walk, and then you limp. And I knew he was hurting. That was tough for my wife to take. But you cannot love your child so much that you allow their disease to cripple them, because then they'll depend on you forever, and you wouldn't have succeeded in raising them.
Sickle cell disease was always in the back of Frempong's mind.
And my mother is really the person that convinced me that I should study the disease that affects my son, because, you know, she's very religious. She thought, well, this is a sign God has chosen that you do this. I don't believe that, but that's what she believes.
Frempong became a national leader in sickle cell and the head of the Sickle Cell Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, one of the top pediatric hospitals in the country. He started a program to get every child born in Philadelphia screened for sickle cell disease. As his professional responsibilities grew, he purposely let go of some of his past.
Most of my patients don't know that I was ever an athlete. I never discussed that with them. It never comes up. If they're going to see me as a role model, I want them to do it as a doctor, something that they can become.
18-year-old Daima Ofer is one of his patients here in Philadelphia. She gets 4 bags of blood transfused every month. Despite the needles and pain, she couldn't help joking with me while the nurses worked around her hospital bed.
I look like Frankenstein when you're all done. I look like needles coming out and wires all over the place.
Daima has been through a lot. The death of her older brother, a victim of sickle cell disease, and the emergency splenectomy that came on a particularly bad day.
They found out it was swollen on my 13th birthday. Yeah, on my 13th birthday, I woke up throwing up, still put on my birthday outfit, throwing up in a bucket, refusing to leave. I wanted to blow out my candles and eat my cake, and everything just ended.
And Dr. Frempong's been there through it all.
He's just real sweet and caring. Growing up, he's like my second dad. So whatever he said, you know, it goes. We listen. He became more than just my doctor. You know, he's great. Now as I got older, though, you know, older, a little rebellious and don't want to listen to what he has to say. So Like, I had recently asked him about a tattoo, and he's like, you have a higher risk of infection. I'm like, okay, I'm still getting it, but okay. He made me think twice about it. Being though my brother passed away, you know, I want the tattoo for him. It's just angel wings in his name. So something a little small and a little cute.
But while he was doing critical work in Philadelphia, Frempong never forgot that the situation was dire back in his home country. So many young children in Ghana were undiagnosed and dying needlessly. Dr. Frempong discovered this terrible fact back in medical school.
At Yale, you have to do some research work and write a thesis. And I wanted to come back to Ghana. So my thesis work was called Child Health in the Ghanaian Community. And I actually studied a 10-year period, what illnesses children were coming to the main hospital there. But what struck me at that time, and my son had already been born, was the incredibly small number of children who were admitted there with sickle cell disease or who died of sickle cell disease. And so I had gone to the director of pediatrics and I said, something here doesn't make sense to me. This disease is supposed to be so common, but when I go through your admissions and in particular your mortality, there are almost no children here with sickle cell. He said most of them die very, very young, and also they're not diagnosed. So some of them come through here. He said the children that are dying from malaria, dying from pneumonia, many of them have sickle cell disease, but they don't get tested for it, so people don't know. So I said, oh, so this is really a problem.
One thing you should know, back to the genetic lottery for a minute. There's a tragic twist of fate that stacks the odds against West Africans and people in other tropical regions. It turns out that while people with one healthy hemoglobin gene and one defective gene, carriers of sickle cell, don't show signs of the disease, they reap an important benefit. Carriers of sickle cell happen to be resistant to malaria, the mosquito-borne killer that still ravages Africa today. So when the DNA mutation for sickle cell occurred thousands of years ago, it stuck around. Healthy sickle cell carriers, protected from malaria, survived especially well, passing the disease to future generations. In 1993, Frempong got money from the National Institutes of Health to take his fight to the epicenter of sickle cell disease. Sickle cell screening of newborns in Kumasi, the second largest city in Ghana, near his hometown. Remember, most babies with sickle cell die in early childhood if they aren't diagnosed and treated, so screening could save thousands of lives. The project got off to a rocky start.
We spent a lot of time designing the health education program because we felt this is the first time newborn babies are having any blood samples drawn on a large scale. But a few weeks into the testing, there was a rumor in the city that if you came to this hospital to have a baby, they'll cut the heel of your baby. And we had to get on radio and public education again to tell them that no, we were not slicing off the heels of babies, that we were just doing a little puncture. So even though we thought we were ready, we hadn't anticipated what would happen.
Now things run smoothly. Here in the newborn screening room at Komfo Anoche Teaching Hospital, about a dozen newborns, a day old, lie in bundles on their mother's lap, waiting for a needle stick to the heel. A nurse squeezes out 4 drops of blood. Blood from those babies makes it to this lab in Ghana's capital. It's only one room, and that clicking is the voltage regulator, which keeps Ghana's power surges from destroying the equipment. But that's only a problem when the power is on, which isn't a guarantee. The staff was awed when I told them that blackouts happen maybe once a year back home. In the lab, they happen every day. But this is where blood from all newborns in Kumasi's public hospitals and private health clinics goes to. Babies born at home also get blood samples taken when they come to hospitals for polio immunizations, so they get tested for sickle cell too. Dr. Frempong has created the only citywide sickle cell screening program in all of West Africa, the global center of sickle cell. The numbers have been staggering. 200,000 babies have been screened in the first 10 years of testing. It's cost only $1.5 million spread over 14 years.
If you go to see the mothers who have come for their results, it's always quite, to me, it's an emotional scene to see so many people who have just come out because their baby has had this test. They're very interested in knowing what it showed. In fact, there was one year the number of babies we tested exceeded the number of births in the city. Babies born in the neighboring towns and villages were coming into the city to be tested because they heard about it.
But 80% of the mothers don't return to get the results of the tests. So when the test results are positive, Dr. Frempong's staff has to go find them.
Today we are going to Asokwa Sub Metro. It's a suburb of Kumasi, where I would say most of our possible STD babies are coming from. We'll be talking to mothers who have babies with possible STD to invite them to the clinic.
Nurse Hannah Tete works for Kumasi's sickle cell program. In Kumasi, Nurse Hannah's expeditions take on unique challenges. When she started making follow-up visits, 96% of parents didn't have home phones. You can't even expect an address.
Houses have these house numbers that only mean something to city surveyors. You know, block 3/1782. And letters are not mailed to the house, so we couldn't mail results, and they might not be able to read them. I have talked to some of the mothers with questions like, if I went to elementary school with you and you hadn't seen me for like the last 25 years and you ran into me at the bus station and you wanted to tell me where you live so that I can come and visit you, my old friend, what would you tell me? And the usual answer is, I will ask you to follow me to my house so you will see where I am.
The first step is getting to the right part of Kumasi, the city.
Then you start using some of the other markers, the landlord's name. And everybody, you know, within a few houses, people will know who was very pregnant, who just recently had a baby. And they say, we're looking for this mother. And everybody says, oh yes, we know that woman. She sells tomato on the market.
Have you accompanied nurses on the visits to see what they're like?
Yes, I have. And I get thrilled because I can't see how in a city of, you know, 800,000 people that you can sort of go blindly with pieces of information whose accuracy you really don't even know and still manage to find 86%.
Hannah takes care not to broadcast what she's doing.
It is always advisable not to hold books, papers, or even be in uniform because some of them get scared. They think it's the environmental health inspector who has come in to send them to court. At times, we have to hide identity and only disclose it to the client.
This trek takes us through brush and on planks over a creek. As Hannah approaches the home, her heels have accumulated mud and grass, and that's not all.
Dogs have chased me. I knocked. I didn't hear anything. And finally, somebody responded. So I opened the gate, not knowing there was a dog there. So the person was shouting and calling the dog to the way. And I didn't know what to do because I couldn't run. And they are very wild. So the person had to come and save me.
When Hannah finally finds a mother and tells her of her baby's positive sickle cell test, she knows what to expect.
I would say that most of them cry. Some become so depressed and you need to console the person that we have a clinic here, we have qualified staff who will be able to help the baby and the parents. Those who know the complications, those who have seen the condition before, they take it very serious. Mm. They cry, but they take the advice very serious. Those who don't cry, it means that they don't know the complications of the condition, and they decide either to come or not to come. But those who refuse to come, some of them lose their babies later.
Today, Hannah discovered that this mother had misunderstood the test showing she and her husband were sickle cell carriers. The mother thought it was impossible they could have a child with sickle cell. After Hannah explained, the mother sat on the couch with her sleeping baby, absorbing the information. How did you feel when Hannah told you the news? What were you thinking?
Oh, I'm not scared, but what I can say that my baby is not having that disease. It's not possible that.
Mm-hmm. But now you think it's possible?
That one I can't tell. True, I can't tell.
She was anxious, her leg tapping up and down, but she didn't cry. This woman didn't seem like she was ready to believe.
Yes, she didn't. She said it was not possible. I knew she was disturbed. Mm-hmm. She was worried because she never thought that she can get a baby with sickle cell disease.
Fortunately, this mother did end up coming to Dr. Frempong's clinic for education. Another trip that day wasn't quite as successful. At one house, the mother was out, but a grandmother was at home. Hannah has to judge whether it's safe to leave test results with another family member.
If the grandmother were to be literate, that's why we could have left the information with her. Those who are illiterate like that, sending the information over to the mother can bring so many problems. There's so many instances where the information was related to mother-in-law or mother, and the marriage had to come to an end. Yes, yes. So we are very careful. We are very careful.
Why so careful? One thing I quickly learned about Dr. Frempong's battle against sickle cell was in some ways it's as much a social mission as a medical one. Sickle cell patients in Ghana face a strong stigma that can be as bad or worse than the stigma associated with HIV/AIDS. Some people say patients fake their pain symptoms. Others don't understand that the disease is treatable and that patients can live long and full lives. Emmanuel, the sickle cell patient who lost his arm in a bus accident, explains the general view of the disease.
Really, when people see you amputated and all that, they sympathize with you. But when you have sickle cell, someone who is going to die very soon, well, who cares?
Benjamin, a high school student, faces abuse from his classmates.
Sometimes at school, people treat you as if you are not a human being. It's like a stigma. They call us sickless.
Those closest to the patients sometimes commit the most hurtful acts. I met Letitia Usu at an educational session at the hospital in Kumasi. She's 37 and has sickle cell. She didn't know it until she was married and gave birth to her first child. Her husband kept her disease a secret until a second child was born when he told his parents of Letitia's condition. Her in-laws pressured her husband to leave Letitia and their two children. He left. Letitia struggled to make ends meet by selling bread, eggs, and oranges at the side of the road. Now she has no job and relies on her brother, who lives out of town. He sends her about $25 a month and gave her the 30 cents she needed to get to the hospital today. She lives in a compound house and has to keep the disease a secret from other occupants. Meanwhile, her husband has a new wife and kids, but Letitia has no communication with him. I was shocked to hear from doctors and patients that these abandonments weren't rare. This is Chasing the Crescent Moon, the story of Dr. Frempong and sickle cell disease. When we return, we'll hear what Dr. Frempong is doing to fight ignorance about sickle cell. Also, we'll visit Dr. Frempong's clinic in Ghana right after this. You're listening to Chasing the Crescent Moon, the story of Dr. Frempong and sickle cell disease. Dr. Frempong works to combat the misconceptions about sickle cell that can break up families in Ghana. One common one is, if a child is born with sickle cell, it's the mother's fault. In fact, it takes two copies of the defective gene, one from each parent.
That's the first lesson, that is two people. But, you know, the concept that, you had a momentary contact with a woman who then kept the child for 9 months, and the child is born with the disease, you figure, well, this child lived with you for 9 months, so whatever the child got is not me. Child never stayed with me. You know, so the concept of actually passing genes on at the moment of conception, that is totally new.
Solomon Anodoku, a health educator at Frempong's clinic, is the man with a microphone, telling patients about managing their disease and dispelling common myths. He's charismatic and keeps his audience engrossed. Sometimes he counsels individuals.
The hardest one that I've seen is when a woman came to our clinic and started crying because the husband has left her because of giving birth to a sickle cell patient. So that woman was so downhearted, so mute that she was not even talking. When we asked her questions, she was crying. I quite remember that day, the husband even accusing her that she has brought a cursed child who cannot live.
Solomon had the husband come to the clinic, took a blood sample, and explained to the man how he had contributed to his child's sickle cell disease. The father took the lesson to heart.
He knew that you have to take care of the child, and they are now happy now.
Even doctors can misinform parents about their child's disease, with tragic consequences. Peter Kokwazimo is a social studies and English teacher. His only son was born with sickle cell. At 12, the boy was hospitalized.
My wife was there when it happened. So when she woke up, she wanted to find out whether the pain has subsided, but you realize there was no life in him again. All of us felt so bad. We felt so bad because he's the only boy that I had, and since then, all my kids are girls. It's painful, and it still pains me because I found out that if I had ideas, I don't think the boy would have died.
What do you mean, if you had ideas?
Yeah, because why I'm saying this, the doctor told me that because he has had that sickle cell disease, he's not going to live beyond 15 years. Okay? And I believed that story. So, you see, when he was even sick, I think I have to blame myself for not maybe taking proper care of the boy, because I have already been told that you won't go beyond the 15 years.
Because of the doctor's bad advice, Peter had given up on his son and didn't put his heart into his care. He didn't learn that patients could thrive until his boy had died, but he had another opportunity. Peter and his wife gave birth to two healthy girls, but they tried once more for a boy, and their fourth child, a girl, was born with sickle cell. This time, though, things would be different. Peter made a promise to God.
I have to make sure that she does not die as said by the doctor. So in fact, I take charge of everything. I bring her to the clinic, make sure she takes her medication. I sit down with her and advise her to go to school and make sure she should be rest assured that I am here, I am there for her. She knows. She said, okay, he's always praying that I won't die. I have taken that responsibility. It takes a lot from my salary, but as long as I've vowed that I make sure that he lives, even if I spend all what I have on her, I don't mind.
Peter has become an organizer for the city's Sickle Cell Association and a vocal advocate of the clinic. If he spots a child with sickle cell, he tells the parents to come to the clinic and gives them taxi fare to get there. Some of the stigma of sickle cell results from thinking that patients will die soon, but some comes from fear of forces that never die.
And I remember in 1995, we were here to have our first international symposium, and I saw in the newspapers that there was a boy, I think he was like 11 or 12 years old, who had traveled all the way to Accra to look for his father. The boy had come on his own. He was actually sort of missing because he had been branded as some kind of warlord, that he was possessed by the devil. And his picture was in the paper. I could tell this child has sickle cell disease. And then they described his ulcer that doesn't go away and all of these things. And that he has died many times. And probably he was comatose at some point from stroke or something. And wherever he's from, you know, maybe a small rural area, they just didn't know much about sickle cell disease, and the people there were making his life miserable.
Ghana is a very religious country. Almost every shop I saw in Kumasi had a religious name, no matter the product. God's Love Auto Parts, for example. Andrew Zajay is the head of the government's health education unit in Kumasi. He explains that diseases like sickle cell are still chalked up to supernatural causes.
It's quite difficult to separate an African from his or her religion, because we started with this traditional religion. Our whole world, everything was explained in religion. When there is a disease, like cholera, they think that it's a disaster from the gods. So they will go and pacify to the gods. Gradually, Western medicine, science and technology all came in to show that most of these things, they have physical causes. But majority still think that some spirits somewhere are doing certain things.
According to Ajay, it's even the Christian church that perpetuates this belief.
I don't know how Christianity is practiced in other places, but in Ghana here, Christianity wants to tell you that the world is a very dangerous place, full of spirits. And whatever happens to you, it's not by chance. It's by a certain spirit. And therefore, you need to be very close to God to be able to offset those spirits.
Dr. Frempong's sickle cell team has to convince patients and their families that the fault isn't in their stars, but in their cells. Dr. Frempong finds even genetics lessons sometimes don't sway the superstitious.
If you say that there were, you know, one chance in four that you could have a child with sickle cell disease, to them, it's not a random activity. Why didn't I get the one chance in four that all the children would be fine? Why my child? Who caused my child to have this? From time to time, we have parents who get very angry at us, because they think we are cursing the children, that here is a healthy looking baby that I just have, I'm happy. Now you're putting this curse on the baby, and you're going to tell me that when this baby grows up, he's going to have symptoms of a disease. And lo and behold, if only you hadn't put that curse on the baby.
In Ghana, Dr. Frempong succeeded in instituting citywide screening for sickle cell. But of course, screening would not be enough. He had to ensure that there was a place families could go for treatment when they learned the diagnosis. So in 1992, around the same time that screening began, he started a clinic at Komfo Anoche Teaching Hospital, the largest hospital in Kumasi. He had to make the most of the hospital's scarce resources, 3 small rooms for a clinic.
It didn't take much time before we exceeded our staff capabilities. We only had 2 half days a week access to that clinic from the start, and we still have only 2 half days a week. And our patient population has gone from 10 to now about 8,000. So there is a built-in serious inefficiency, because many patients cannot wait as long as they have to wait when they come to clinic. They get discouraged and they may not come back.
I'm walking through the doors of the sickle cell clinic at Komfo Anoche Teaching Hospital. It's a clinic day, and behind me sit around 100 patients. They've been waiting for hours, some in serious pain, to enter these 3 small consulting rooms and speak with a doctor for just a few minutes. When Dr. Frempong is in town, he staffs the clinic along with a few other senior attending physicians. I've never seen someone work so hard. He's up before dawn, skips meals to train staff members. Today he was the last person to leave the clinic. And even after he's finally gone home, when patients hear he's in town, they sometimes show up at his door looking for help. While I sit next to him, this is a common refrain.
But don't let me talk too much. I have to work.
While some of the patients come to Frempong's clinic for routine checkups, others are here with severe complications and need to be admitted.
And as a sickle cell disease patient is qualified to be an acute chest syndrome, you would probably have to admit this child.
Here's Dr. Daniel Ansong, one of the head pediatricians.
What sickle cell disease patients usually don't want is to go on an admission. Because when they are leaving the house and the mothers think that, oh, this child has just a cough and a fever, but you would want to take care of the child, and so you would want to keep this child alive. On the first day, second day, then the mother realizes that the condition of the child has become very critical. And at the end, the child is well and is going home. Then the mother comes to you and says, "Doctor, I thank you very much. I didn't know it was going to be such complicated."
Dr. Harry Boteng, one of Frempong's staff, shares a desk with 3 other physicians, each consulting a different patient. 5 or 10 minutes per patient only. There are just so many, and that's their biggest challenge.
The difficulty here is seeing 101 patients after a long day work. I know one patient who came here, the doctor saw, and then stated that the patient was well, stable. So maybe the doctor was tired. The patient went home, and then in the night came for admission because of severe anemia, and then died. We are doing our best. It's not enough.
When patients need to be admitted, the crowd spills into the hospital wards, already filled past capacity. I sometimes saw three children lying sideways, sharing a single hospital bed.
The chief executives of the hospital look at me as if this is the person that brought the problem. And I always tell them, I have never landed in a crowd with a plane load of sickle cell disease patients from elsewhere. They're all here.
In this full clinic, it's hard to believe, but some patients aren't coming when they should. Some parents don't come in because the limited clinic hours make it hard to keep their baby's sickle cell a secret. Nurse Hannah Tete explains.
A lot of people complain because it's in the afternoon. They wish they can come in the morning when everybody has left the house. Then for a mother to leave home in the afternoon to attend the clinic is the hardest area. Because that is the time for her to cook for the husband, and maybe they stay in a compound house. Everybody is cooking. Where are you going with your baby? It's a question. You have to tell somebody that I'm going to clinic or I'm going here. People will ask a lot of questions.
But those who do come often come from far away. It's rare to find a facility staffed by sickle cell experts.
One of the worst things that happens to sickle cell disease patients everywhere is to face health providers who don't know about your disease, and they're asking you questions that you think doctors should know these, that I was born with this disease, that I didn't just catch it. And so we know that some of the young people travel far to get to us. I wish it were not that way. For a country with so many people with this disease, every regional hospital needs to have a sickle cell center.
One of the sickle cell experts at Frempong's clinic is Dora Antori. She's a veteran nurse and a grandmother, but she's there every clinic day dressed in her bright blue uniform. So is the sickle cell clinic your favorite clinic to work on?
Yes.
And why is that?
I love to see people with sickle cell living a stable life and healthy life. So I want to do all I can to help in the management of sickle cell.
And for good reason. She's a nurse, but she has sickle cell herself. So do you find yourself ever being a patient at the sickle cell clinic?
Yes.
So the patients know that you have sickle cell?
At the emergency unit, I at times go on admission and meet some of them.
It's been a challenge working in the hospital. She's on her feet most of the time and had to stop working the wards to avoid contagious diseases and the resulting sickle cell complications. But in the sickle cell clinic, she has a special place, inspiring hope.
When we are counseling the mothers with newborn babies, they will look devastated and worried. So at times I tell them I had a disease too. And they don't even believe me. And they say I'm just saying that for them to feel relieved.
She holds up her left hand for proof with a shortened middle finger from childhood symptoms. Growing up, Nurse Dora found out firsthand the kind of abusive treatment sickle cell patients faced while in pain. The trauma of one teenage hospitalization inspired her.
When I was in secondary school, I once had the sickle cell pain, and I was admitted in a hospital in the Eastern region. That place is quite cold. The temperature is cold. The ward was full, and I was put on a stretcher on a veranda. The pain got worse, and I asked the night nurse to at least send me to a place where there's warmth so that I'll be able to sleep. And she took me to a side ward where an old lady was dying. I was so sick and scared at that time. I was about 15 or so. And to be sleeping with someone who was dying. And that was a very bad experience for me. So I decided there and then that I'll do my best to become a nurse so that I can help sickle cell patients in pain.
It doesn't surprise me.
Frempong thinks he knows why patients with sickle cell are often treated badly by hospital staff.
You know, the medical profession sometimes acts like military establishment. They feel as if their job is to finish something, is to just complete it and wrap it up. And when a patient keeps coming back with the same symptoms, whether it's sickle cell disease, asthma, diabetes, it's not something we can wrap up, we can clean up. So they begin to think that those people must be inducing their illness themselves. Oh, he must have been out drinking, or he must have been out partying, there he's back again. After a while, you begin to see that there is almost like a hatred developing for the patient, for the victim of the disease, simply because their own inability to correct the problem exposes their limitations. They begin to take it out on the patient.
This is Chasing the Crescent Moon, the story of Dr. Frempong and sickle cell disease. After a short break, we'll hear how sickle cell can present an awful choice to Ghanaians looking to start a family. You're listening to Chasing the Crescent Moon, the story of Dr. Frempong and sickle cell disease. The treatments sickle cell patients receive in Kumasi are penicillin prophylaxis to prevent infection and folic acid to help blood regeneration, just like in the U.S. But a couple Ghanaian patients mentioned a more unorthodox remedy. Again, Emmanuel Kolite.
You know, someone told me that if you mixed 10 tomato with Coca-Cola, it will increase your blood within a short time. But once I tried it, and I thought it worked. My mom somehow also tried it, but she continued the next day and had to lie down for a long time. She felt sick. So we're very much afraid now to go near that thing again.
Coke and tomatoes don't work to regenerate blood. And for the severe pain of sickle cell disease, even doctors don't have much to offer. Ghanaian patients are normally only prescribed ibuprofen, where American patients would get morphine or other powerful opiates. So Ghanaians try methods that are not doctor-recommended, like tying the affected body part tightly with rope. Again, Andrew Zajay, the health educator.
The time blocks the nerve endings so that the person does not feel the pain, right? Some of them, they will even put a huge substance like block or a heavy metal on the painful parts. Then they get some kind of relief. However, when you do that, then you block the other smaller vessels, and that can lead to the hand becoming dead. So we caution them against all those things.
Fortunately for Ghanaian patients, a new national healthcare system is allowing many major medical expenses of sickle cell patients to be covered for free. But the service is new, and most Ghanaians have yet to sign up. If uninsured patients can't pay their bills when they're discharged from the hospital keeps them there, sometimes for weeks until the bill is settled. It's the same reason informing parents of newborn screening results is so difficult. With no address or phone, there's no way to ensure payment if the hospitals let the patients go. And Frempong adds that even when patients make it to hospitals, one powerful weapon against sickle cell isn't available in Ghana. Blood banks haven't developed far enough.
What is lacking here is the preventive use of blood transfusion services. We cannot do that here at this point. And it's a major difference. In the U.S., about 20% of our SS patients in our clinic are on chronic transfusion therapy to prevent stroke, to prevent acute chest syndrome, some of the major complications of the disease.
And Ghanaian sickle cell patients also face a deadly killer, one that's been eradicated in the U.S. Remember, one copy of the sickle cell gene provides a natural resistance to malaria, which is why the gene is so common. But there's another tragic evolutionary irony. Two copies makes it harder to fight a malarial infection.
Malaria is the leading cause of death in children with sickle cell disease in Africa. It is so in our clinic here. You know, malaria in otherwise healthy children kills mostly from severe anemia. And if you're already anemic, you just cannot spare any more red cells to be destroyed by malaria parasite. That's why children with sickle cell succumb so much faster.
Frempong and his project staff aren't just working to improve care for patients. They're also talking to the public about how to prevent sickle cell from striking the next generation. Here in the clinic, a class is in session on the sickle cell genetic lottery. The instructor uses a box and four ping pong balls to show the 25% chance two carriers will have a child with sickle cell. He points out that having one child with sickle cell doesn't lower or raise the chance the next child will have the disease. One mother in Kumasi recently had six children, all with sickle cell. Those born before Dr. Frempong's project all died, but those born since are now in high school. Many churches have taken it upon themselves to make sure couples are tested for sickle cell before marriage. Carriers of sickle cell are mostly AS, which means they have one healthy gene A and one unhealthy gene S. If the bride and groom are both AS, some churches might pressure them to split up or even refuse to marry them. The discovery can be devastating for the couples. Shocked fiancés have threatened suicide at the thought of being split up. But every parent of a patient we spoke to said, without hesitation, if they knew they were carriers, they would never have married their spouses. Like Peter Kokwazamo.
So if you knew what you know now, would you have married your wife?
Not at all, my brother. Not at all. No. It's very painful. I mean, you have not gone into that situation before. No. It's very painful. You see your daughter wailing in pain. There's nothing you can do.
And Elizabeth Timma, a sickle cell patient who is 25 and single.
So I think if we are deciding on marriage, it's better we live alone than to bear sickle cell child. I think that decision is not reasonable.
Even Dr. Frempong, who is a sickle cell carrier and has a child with sickle cell disease, hesitated when asked this question. He explained that Ghanaians see love differently than Americans.
Marriage in our traditional setting is a practical arrangement with one major purpose, and that's to have children. You can't go to your father and say, I want to marry that young man because I love him. Your father will say, so why do you want to marry him? You say, because I love him. You say, but that's no reason to marry somebody just because you love him. They want to hear things like, he's got good character, he's from a good family. They really think that the love will come. And nobody will say that I desire children with disease.
Some go even further. Peter, who lost one child to sickle cell, has a radical view. There ought to be a law, he says.
There must be a policy that before two people can marry, they should go to tests and then find out their status. Those AS plus AS should not get married.
You would make it illegal for two AS people to get married?
Yes, I would. I would, because now when you meet people who don't have children with sickle cell disease, they have not had that emotional stress. They say, oh, because of love, oh, don't worry, because they love each other. So if those pragmatic measures are not taken, it will continue like this, 2% of the children born.
For Ghanaians who have the disease, the stigma and pragmatic marriage philosophy sometimes make finding a spouse very difficult. Sickle cell patient Emmanuel Kolate tells the story of what happened to two other patients, one his friend. It's a tragedy worthy of Shakespeare.
They couldn't get partners, and so finally they concluded, well, let's go on. And it happens. Sickle cell, people are rejecting you, so why don't you keep to yourselves?
They decided to marry each other, even though all of their children would certainly have sickle cell.
Now, it was a difficult decision for the man, and the woman was in tears. They consulted my mom, and my mom said, no, guys, this is dangerous. They had their first child, a girl. When they were having the second child, a boy, the woman passed away through crisis during the delivery. After some time, the son also passed away. So he lived with this girl. But then later on, the girl died. Recently, the girl died. She was about 15 years. the man was touched. You could see him sometimes, we heard, with the child's dresses and all that. And we concluded that the man's life could end at this point in time. It was like that. I think a month later or so, he fell sick and then he didn't survive. He died.
If Dr. Frempong can get education to adolescents in school, a goal of his, students could have plenty of time to plan and avoid these painful decisions. Sickle cell patients can and do have children. And for every person, there are plenty of potential mates with whom there is no possibility of having a child with sickle cell. By all accounts, during Dr. Frempong's summers in Ghana, he works day and night against the social and medical obstacles of sickle cell. His favorite question he hears back in the States is, "How was your vacation?" His time in Ghana is hardly a holiday. Tina Aye, who works at the screening lab, sees this firsthand.
We want him to settle, we want him to cool down because we need him alive. Sometimes I have to go begging him to eat. The food will be on his desk, the computer will be right in front of him, so you know that the attention is on his work and not on his food. He's working hard to help his country, and we are grateful to have somebody like him.
And it's paying off. So walking down the streets of Kumasi, I found most people knew about sickle cell. They had heard about it on Dr. Frempong's radio programs or at their churches, or because they knew babies who had been screened. Still, Dr. Frempong has a lot of work ahead of him in Ghana. Gears are turning to make his citywide newborn screening program into a national one, with sickle cell clinics around the country. This would be an enormous expansion of his already unprecedented project. On Dr. Frempong's other front, in the U.S., every newborn is screened for sickle cell, but this success was a long time coming. Slaves suffered from the disease for 300 years, showing symptoms that were in sight but out of mind for doctors. It wasn't until 1904 in a Chicago hospital that a physician identified sickle cell disease for the first time. And because of the racial disparities in healthcare, the man whose moon-shaped blood cells were finally seen under a microscope wasn't even African American. He was a foreign dental student from Grenada. Since then, it's been a struggle to make sickle cell a national priority. Some states didn't institute newborn screening until the 90s. And even today, when patients go to the ER in crisis, they often face staff ignorant of sickle cell and suspicious that the patients are drug addicts. But there have been successes, like the 11-year-old Johnson twins, Christian and Christopher, patients at Dr. Frempong's clinic in Philadelphia.
CJ, come on, get a hot sauce. Chris, I get a french fry. Okay, here's that for.
Their complications have been minimal. They've had their gallbladders taken out, and they're afraid to tell their friends about the disease, for fear they'll think it's contagious. When Ghanaian doctors see photos of patients like Christopher and Christian, they can't believe the children have sickle cell. Dr. Frempong says regular blood transfusions often produce such dramatic results.
If we take one-year-old, two-year-olds with severe forms of sickle cell disease, and we keep them on chronic transfusion therapy, they will not have symptoms of the disease. Our longest transfused patients are now in their mid to late 30s. They don't know what sickle cell disease is.
Still, things are far from perfect for patients with sickle cell, even in the U.S. And Dr. Frempong would like to see some changes. First, he thinks national health care is necessary so that parents don't hesitate for one second before bringing their children to the hospital if they need care. And while his greatest hope is that someone puts him out of business with a cure, he says it's hard to anticipate a fix when sickle cell is under the public's radar. The lack of interest in sickle cell translates into a lack of funding, despite the high incidence of the disease.
For the whole country, for the diseases for which we test newborn babies, and that includes cystic fibrosis, sickle cell disease, hypothyroidism, and many other conditions, all of them, sickle cell disease is the most common serious genetic disease that affects children, even though it affects largely just African-American and a few Asian and Mediterranean people. So this is a very common disease. Of course, if you extend it to places like Africa, then it becomes even unbelievable, because in this country, sickle cell disease affects about 1 in 2,500 babies. In the African-American community, it's 1 in 400. In West Africa, it's 1 in 50. 2% of the babies have sickle cell disease in West Africa. This is real public health. Even if an infection affected 2% of any population, it would be an epidemic. But you think of a lifelong genetic disease that affects that many people. So in this country now, we think that those who are living will be about 80,000 sickle cell disease patients. Cystic fibrosis is probably the most common serious genetic disease in the Caucasian childhood population. They have about 30,000 patients. Not to say that they have taken money from the sickle cell, but they are a much more successful group in terms of funding support. And I think that they develop newer treatments at a much faster rate.
In the 1970s, sickle cell was in the public eye, but things have changed.
In fact, many in the African-American community who are older, because they don't hear as much about sickle cell disease now, would say something like, is this still around? Because they remember when they used to hear so much about it. So some of them think, well, maybe it was cured.
It wasn't, at least not universally. A bone marrow transplant, which replaces the cells that create blood, can cure sickle cell patients. But it's risky and expensive. And Frempong says only about 15% of patients can find a donor match. A universal cure may come from gene therapy, the replacement or repair of mutant genes that cause sickle cell. But Frempong has seen research projects on the subject unable to get funding.
The current group that's been talking to me in the last 5-6 weeks actually have a gene therapy plan for introducing normal genes into the cells that are making sickle cells. They couldn't get funding in the U.S., and they're going to do this work in France. And so we're not getting as much support as they should be.
Frempong's son is doing fine, despite his sickle cell disease. He's working in software for AT&T. But Frempong never thought, when his child was born, that the current state of sickle cell would be what it is.
It's hard for me to think that my son is 35 years, and in 35 years of expecting something better for people with sickle cell disease, that we still don't have an easy solution to the disease. When he was born, I really thought that it wouldn't be that long before sickle cell disease will have some truly great treatment or cure. And it's hard to look back and see that it's been 35 years and we're still dealing with most of the major complications of the disease are still there.
Sitting in his hotel room in Ghana after a long day, he remains cautiously optimistic.
Do you think that you'll see a cure for sickle cell in your lifetime?
Right now I'm excited about the gene repair therapy, but even if that were to occur, I have to tell you that it would take a long time and a major effort for that cure to reach most people with sickle cell disease in the world. You know, here we are, we can't even diagnose these babies and give them penicillin. You know, 90% of sickle cell patients are in Africa. And we have to find them. So a few patients somewhere may get this gene repair therapy if it becomes real, but we still have hundreds of thousands of patients who are not even getting the diagnosis made. So we have a lot more work to do.
And work is something Dr. Frempong has never shied away from. He doesn't look it, but Frempong is 61, and he's toying with the idea of retiring. But it's not the kind of retirement you might expect. He's thinking of leaving Philadelphia for 10 years home in Ghana, devoting himself full-time to sickle cell. His patients will certainly be happy to see him year-round.
Oh, he's our man, he's our mentor, he's the person that we love. Almost all the children, if they hear his name, they become very happy. So, America, we love doctor. Take care of him for us.
Chasing the Crescent Moon was made possible by a grant from the Roland J. Penick Fellowship at Swarthmore College. Additional support from the University of Pennsylvania's Africa Studies Center. Marty Goldenson was the executive editor. Ren Elhai, Elizabeth Fraukelt, and David Gelber helped to edit the program. Special thanks to Colin Angevine and Dr. Don Silverberg. Chasing the Crescent Moon was written and produced by me, Aaron Schwartz. Thanks for listening. To contribute to Dr. Frempong's work in Ghana, visit his foundation's website at sicklecellghana.org.